Blog Talk Radio.
Time is now 6:03 p.m. on the East Coast, 3:03 p.m. on the West Coast, and you're tuned in to the TMGS. It's the Michael Gay Show, broadcasting on the TMGN, the Michael Gay Network. Tonight, we do have some topics we're going to talk about, and I'm sure many of you have seen the disturbing video of Tyre Nichols being beaten in the manner that he was by some officers, people that are supposed to protect and serve. I'm sorry, I have to go over here, open up the chat room real quick. Chat room, whoever's listening online, let me go ahead and make sure that I open up this chat room for you, okay? So you can post your questions or comments. Very disturbing piece of footage. It's not like it's the first time we've seen this. We've seen where officers have shot unarmed people. We've seen where officers have, done things and everything. But we haven't seen, at least for me, I haven't seen where The footage that I looked at was so horrific of how they treated this young man. I didn't see anything that showed that he was doing anything wrong whatsoever. Nothing. I didn't see anything that showed that he was trying to fight back against the officers. He asked a simple question. What did I do? That's all he asked. What did I do? Anybody being pulled over for a traffic violation will ask that simple question. What did I do? What's wrong? Oh, well, your taillight is out. Oh, I didn't know that. I don't stand behind my car or in front of my car. But maybe I need to, you know, whenever I'm parked, ask someone, you know, let me know if my taillight is out. Step on my brakes and see that my brake lights are on. Can you stand in front of my car and make sure that my blinkers are working right? You know, simplest things. But you can get pulled over for those infractions. And all of a sudden, excuse my language, but that's what happened. And they still don't know what really was the infraction. They claim that he was driving erratically. That's what they claim. We don't see that video of him driving erratically, because they didn't turn on the dash cam when he was allegedly doing that. We're going to talk about that later on the show. But right now, what I want to do is talk about a couple of other things ahead of time. There are some guests I did invite to come on, gave them a time frame to come on, and hopefully they will join us shortly. I know some of them said they were going to be a little late, might be about 15 minutes into the show. That's fine, but I'm looking forward, because these individuals I reach out to are former police officers, black police officers. And I think after the conversation I had with them today, some of them said that it really hurt their heart. Truly, it hurts everybody's heart to see something like this from the people that are supposed to protect and serve. But for the black community, I think it's even deeper. And we'll talk about that when our guests join us. But as usual, I have to open up the board and bring in my co-hosts, the individuals that always have my back here, even though we have our ups and downs. The thing is, we make it work. And that's the blessing. We make it work. We continue to do what we do. And we do this to share it with you, get people's points of views. So without further ado, let me introduce the lady of the house, Miss Janet Polly Hawkins Davis.
Hey, Michael.
Hi, Janet.
How are you?
Hey.
So you said we have our ups and downs, huh?
Yeah, we all have our ups and downs. You know that. I'm just being honest.
Yeah.
Everybody do. You have your ups and downs, and you know the ups are better than
the
downs, right?
Keep the man in line anyway, Michael.
If everybody heard our conversations, they'd be like, damn. It'd be a show on its own. But we're not going to share that one. We'll wait till next year. But
okay.
Yeah, I want to hold off on this conversation, because I want to make sure that the officers that are going to come online. Well, in fact, here's one here now. I'm going to open up his mic. Officer Crenshaw is here with us. I'm going to open his mic in a moment, Terry. But
All right. We're
going to talk about some small things first, because I want to give everybody a chance to chime in. I know that some said that it's going to be about maybe, you know, 10, 15 minutes after the show airs that they're going to be able to jump on the board. So that's cool. So I want to give everybody a chance to chime in, right? All right. But Officer Crenshaw's here. We have to greet him. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Officer Jeffrey Crenshaw.
Hello, everybody.
Hey, Crenshaw.
Hey, Janet. Hey, Michael Gaines.
I'm going to have to record that the next time you do it. Okay.
Oh, no.
Yeah. All right. Give him a taste of his own medicine.
How y'all doing today? Fine. Well, I can't say fine, to be honest. I mean, what happened last night was disturbing, but I don't want to go into that right now. I want to get everybody on board before we go into that conversation. You know how I schedule stuff.
Yeah.
I want to get to certain things first and get them out the way and your thoughts and about it, and you share it. And then move on to this, because this here, this whole thing that happened is, I mean, it's mind-boggling, but we've seen it before. It's just, you know, that we haven't seen it in the way that we saw this particular video. That's what I really want to talk about, and how quickly the process went of indicting these officers, arresting these officers, and charging these officers compared to past incidents like this, right? We have to talk about all that.
Right.
So we're going to hold on for a moment. But, Janet, I want you to bring this in on here's where some very disturbing videos were shared this week. One was where Nancy Pelosi's husband was cracked in the head by an individual who broke into their home. And had a hammer, not a gun. He had a hammer.
Well, he had more than a hammer, but that's what he used. Yeah.
Well, that's what he used, right? But that was in his hand, as I said. That was in his hand. So the video shows us where the cops have their camera on, seeing what's going on. Right.
Mm-hmm.
See, if you haven't seen it, you can look it up. You guys can look at it while you are listening to the show. And all of a sudden, this guy reaches up and he swings and hits this man in his head. My question is that did the cops have their guns out at that time? Because
no.
Here's a weapon. Okay. Now, you said
you
no,
know,
right?
That's what got me. They stood there in the door and said, put the hammer down. Because he saw them struggling. Nancy, Paul Pelosi was holding onto the guy's hammer. And so they're both just standing there when the police opened the door, and he already had called the police. I'm surprised the dispatcher actually figured out what he was trying to say. You know, he asked for Capitol Police. He said he was Nancy Pelosi's husband. He said the guy was there at the house. He didn't know the guy, even though the guy said he was a friend, you know. But the police was just had the door open. They said put the hammer down. And then the guy lunged and hit Nancy Pelosi's husband in the head. But I think he already had hit him with the hammer on his hand. You know. Then they charged after him. With a hammer, they should have pulled the gun out right then.
Okay. So but here's the thing. It should have been obvious.
Yeah.
That this don't look right. Well, let me say this. Should have been obvious is that you're at Nancy Pelosi's house. Okay. Now, I don't know if those cops knew that for a fact. I really don't know. I guess, you know, if they release the audio of the 911 call and everything from her husband, you know, which I'm pretty sure he probably said who he was. Did 911 know? Okay, so but let me finish. Here's the thing that gets me. I would think in any other situation, guns would have been drawn. Honestly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Guns would have been drawn the moment they saw that hammer in his hand. Because that's a weapon, right, Officer Crenshaw? That's a weapon. That person
mm-hmm.
is not only used towards the person that they're holding hostage, but towards you. Am I right, sir?
Right.
So how
gun,
come
taser, something. But, you know, you they're coming up on a situation to where when the way he made the call and as calm as he was, and I commend him being 80-something years old and staying that calm.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm. Right.
They had no idea. They had no idea that was Nancy Pelosi's husband because he never mentioned her name. He said, the gentleman
yes,
is still waiting on my wife.
He said he mentioned her name. He said
he mentioned her name.
Capitol Police. Yeah, he said it's the Capitol Police there. They said, no, this is the regular police department. Then he said, well, I'm Paul Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi's husband. She's not at home, but I have this gentleman, this guy here, waiting for her to come home. Mm-hmm.
Okay, hold on a minute. Hold on a minute. Hold on a minute, though. Was this said to, now follow me first, was this said in the 911 call or was it said to the officers that came?
911.
Because, see, the officers at the door. Okay, so then they're right there. That tells you something, is that where 911 obviously did not transfer that information over to the officers on the crime scene. You follow me? I mean, he probably said that, as you said, to the he probably said that to the 911 operator. But then,
he did.
When the 911, okay, right, you said that he did that. But then, the 911 operator, I'm assuming, did not forward the information, the fact that this is Nancy Pelosi's house. See what I'm saying? And this is her husband. You know, this is. That's where the lack of communication falls into place. Okay, this is
And he did say that the police was normally there, but she was out of town, and this guy was So I mean, what made it so bad? The 911 dispatch operator was trying to hang up, and then he had to say, hold, wait, you know. And explain a little bit more to her
Said, hold on, Janet. You said the 911 operator tried to hang up.
Yeah, she was trying to end the call because she was thinking everything was okay, and he kept saying no because he didn't know the guy, and he was trying to be cool to not get the guy excited or upset.
Upset, whatever, right? So okay, so based on this whole story. And keep in mind for all the listeners, okay, this attack was over 2 months ago, but we just recently, this week, saw the video, or late part of last week, saw the video
so
of the attack.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and many
so
folks
standing there
say that,
looking at,
well,
standing there,
go ahead.
standing there in the door, and looking at the two men there, what would
one in
the
underwear.
Average person What would the average person think?
Yeah.
It's
Holden,
a lovely call.
If you were
wait,
on that type
wait.
Of call, no, I want to ask
wait,
you a question here.
No,
I
was just
trying
saying
to ask
the average
you a
person would think it's
mm-hmm.
a lover's quarrel. They're arguing.
Right.
They don't know either one of those men, so they don't know who's the aggressor and who's not. They're focused on the hammer. Their taser should have been out because when they said drop the hammer, the one guy said no and started trying to pull it from the other guy's hand. That's who they should have been focused on at that point. They should have been moving a little bit quicker to get inside because when he did snatch the hammer out of his hand, Nancy Pelosi's husband tried to run, and that's when he caught him with the hammer.
He lunged at him.
Looking at it, first impression, you got two men standing there, one holding a hammer, one's trying to get the hammer from him. You don't know who's the aggressor, and it looks like a drink or a glass of water in the other one's hand. I commend Mr. Pelosi because when he snatched the hammer out of my hand, I would have smacked him across the face with the glass of water. I commend him on that.
Yeah.
He didn't do that. He just tried to separate himself between that guy and the police, and that guy lunged at him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a hard scenario, not knowing who's the aggressor, but there is a weapon present, and they're both trying to hold on to the hammer.
But
and
when
that's
you saw
my
the
point.
Guy lunged,
well, hold on a minute. That's my point. That there's a weapon present. Now, we don't see the officer's point of view, but I want to know, you know, did an officer have a taser or presented a taser? Because there's a weapon present. That's all I'm saying. There's a weapon.
Yeah, we don't. They don't show it, and from their mannerism, it sounded like they walked up into Beverly Hills, you know, subdivision, you know, smiling, you know, banana up the tailpipe. Bird, get out of here. I'm sorry, I had a bird fly in my garage.
okay. You understand my point? You know, the things that were, but if that had been anything else, but, you know, and we're going to get into that conversation, we're going to get into those questions of when you see something that don't look right. I don't see anything right where here it is at whatever time of the morning or the night, and here's two men standing here. I'm being called on a call as an officer, and then, you know, when I confront the individuals, one has a hammer in their hand. If they have a phone, okay. Phone, cool. But a hammer? I'm like, can you put that down? Because now I feel like, I'm in danger. See, now I get that when a cop says, well, I felt like I was in danger. Yeah, they had something that could be used as a weapon, which actually it became one. And Mr. Pelosi got cracked in the head. Well, this officer pretty much could have made that not happen, that he had said, hey, look, put that down, first of all. I don't want you to have anything in your hands as we're talking. Okay? That's what I'm thinking.
They didn't have a chance for that, Michael, because as soon as the door opened, they said, oh, what you doing with the hammer? And then he tried to yank it from Paul Pelosi, and he was holding on. He said, uh-uh. And then when the guy snatched the hammer, Paul Pelosi tried to run away. He lunged at him. That's how he ended up falling on top
of him. Janet, I saw the video just like you did.
Yeah.
I saw the video just like you did. Okay, so let me say this. I saw the video. I saw how it wasn't moving that fast. It didn't move that fast. And anybody listening, you can go ahead and look at the video and correct me if I'm wrong. No, Janet, let me finish. I'm speaking, please. You can respond. It didn't move that fast. It was where the door opened up. There was a little slight conversation, okay? And, you know, the officer said what he said. I did not hear the officer say, hey, put that down. They didn't rush in there and grab him. He didn't say, can you put that down?
I didn't say that.
I said, no, okay, I know you didn't say that. I'm saying what I'm saying. The moment as an officer, and Officer Crenshaw can correct me if I'm wrong, if you come into a door and someone has something that can be a potential weapon, Officer Crenshaw, what would you tell them? You're not going to sit there and talk, but what would you do?
You guys need one. Y'all need to put the hammer down.
That's what they need. Put the hammer down.
Both
Janet,
of them are holding
Hold on, Janet. Hold on. So, Officer Crenshaw, the moment that door opened, what would be your first response? You said you got to put that down, right?
Right.
Okay, but that did not happen.
No, his first response was, hey, is everything okay here?
Right.
You know.
Worst response I ever heard,
but
looking at a person with
also,
a hammer in their hand.
It depends on, and this is what I've seen through policing and what I've heard been directed through policing, depends on where you're policing at. Like in Atlanta, south side of town, you know, hey, you need to drop that hammer. North side of town, Buckhead, Midtown, you know, it's a little bit more polite. And the reason being is they're worried about the complaint coming through afterwards, even if nothing happens. They're worried that the complaint comes through saying the officer showed up at my door and he drew his gun on me. Without even knowing the situation, they're going to start investigating and find out why. Okay, got there, he had a hammer, da-da-da-da-da. Okay, he had a weapon. But
we are missing something here. Is that Mr. Pelosi? Excuse me, though. I have to intervene here. What we're missing is that Mr. Pelosi was on the phone, right?
Right.
Was he not? Talking to who?
911 before the officer
So, but still, and again, he was talking to 911 while they were in transition to the, or they were on their way to that location. So the 911 officer, of course, has communication with the officers, right?
Right.
Now, based on what Mr. Pelosi was saying, and, of course, 911 officers are trained pretty much like regular officers, like if they were on the street. Am I right or wrong? I know many 911 officers. We've had one as a guest on the show and told me. They are pretty much trained like officers. They are officers.
Only in certain departments. Some of them are officers that no longer work the street. Some of them are civilians. But they used to go through a transition course to where the dispatchers would have to come out and ride with the officers to see what's going on, and the officers would have to go up and work in the 911 communication center to know what's going on. Mm-hmm. So the relationship is better between each.
Right. Okay. So as I said, or as I was saying, we've had a 911 officer on here, and what she shared was that the fact that they've gone through pretty much the same type of training, like if they were on the street. Okay, they have to envision it. They have to go out there with officers, as you just said, because they have to, you know, not dream or visualize what the situation is. They have to see some of that, right? They have to go out there in some jurisdictions. And I get it, and I understand that, and I believe that is definitely the way that some departments operate, because you are a crisis center. You have to visualize the situation in order for you to share it to the officer who is going to approach the scene. So with that being said, I would think that if Mr. Pelosi was on the phone talking to a 911 operator, every bit of information that is going to be helpful for that officer, that 911 operator is going to share it, that he's got a hammer or he's in my house. I don't know him. First of all, I don't know this person. I don't know who he is. So when the officer comes, and if the 911 operator shares that information that the caller is saying that they don't know who this person is, this and the other, take precaution here. Could be a burglary. And here's this person got a hammer in their hand. Come on now. I would have, if I was officer, I would have my taser out immediately, be like, oh, wait a minute. This don't
look
right.
You would think that was going to happen, but that don't happen in all cases.
Okay.
You know, everybody doesn't get all the information that they should get in all cases.
Okay. I agree with that. And why is that? Is it where they're not trained well, or, you know, I mean, I'm just asking. I know it's not your fault or my fault, but it needs to be corrected. So why is that?
I can't say training. I would say more or less like staffing, because you don't have enough 911 operators, for one, to operate all the calls coming in. And then the training they do, it's basically so they can learn the surroundings, so when an officer's trying to maneuver through areas, they have an idea where he's at in case he needs help, or in case if a suspect is fleeing from them, they can tell the officers a good direction to go.
Okay.
But as far as all the information an officer receives on a call, you know, unless it comes in as a high priority, which this probably came in as a mid-grade priority because Mr. Pelosi was so calm. You know,
mm-hmm.
he didn't say anything about him having a weapon. You know, he didn't say anything about, you know, he won't let me leave or anything to that nature. Just somebody here who's waiting on my wife, and I don't know them.
Okay. Hmm. Janet, did you want to chime in into your thoughts about that whole thing? I'm just sharing what I look at, and I'm thinking somewhere the ball was dropped at that front door. I've seen the video somewhere the ball was dropped. Because had that been, in my opinion, had that been just an everyday person, because, of course, this is a very affluent neighborhood. It's not the hood. It's not, you know, Watts or Compton. This is Nancy Pelosi's house. This is, you know, I'm pretty sure that these officers know that in this area, this is where people who work in Congress, this, that, and the other, live. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, they probably know that it's a large amount of lawyers that live in that area, but not exactly who they are or what they do.
Right.
And that's why they were on their best behavior as far as how they approached the house, you know, because I'm sure the supervisor, you know, when they assign them their beat, you know, tells them up front at roll call, you know, this neighborhood is this, this neighborhood is that, you know, do this, do that.
Hmm. Okay. Janet, you have a comment on that?
Well, according to what I read, when mm-hmm. the police officer, when they opened the door, the assailant, the pap, whatever his name was, had his hand on Nancy Pelosi's husband's arm, and the other hand was on the hammer. And Nancy Pelosi's husband's hand was on the hammer. And the police said, drop the hammer. And he said no.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Nancy Pelosi, he tried to pull the hammer away, that's when Paul Pelosi started running in the opposite direction, and he lunged at him. So they just said that the police just said, drop the hammer.
Okay. I guess everybody needs to look at the video. Right. I think if we look at the video again.
I've looked at the video more than one time.
Yeah, okay. Well, I've looked at it, and I'm like, you know, immediately, if I was an officer, you know, and we don't see the point of view of Mr. Pelosi, and I don't know, I'm pretty sure he hasn't spoken about what had occurred. You know, and maybe when that comes about, you know, we can see it and say, oh, okay. You know, but in the time frame of the video I saw, it was enough time for the officers to concentrate more on getting this person with his hammer out of their hand. I'm just saying that's what I'm looking at, because when I look at the video, I'm looking at there was too much time, a weapon. That's my point. That's all I'm saying. It's still a weapon. As an officer, if you have something that you can strike anyone with and cause bodily harm to, the first thing, as an officer, and Officer Crenshaw, I'm sure he will agree with me. If I'm walking up and I open up the door, or you open up the door and you got something that looks like that can harm me or anybody else, first thing, no, you got to drop that. My taser is going to be out. But and there's no negotiation. Once I say drop it, and you tell me no, your ass is tased.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
He lunged right at Paul Pelosi right after he said no. And then they
said, okay. Mike, that sounds good, but things happen within a split second. So by the time
if we look at the video again, I may be wrong, but I felt like too much time went by, because when I saw the video, the moment he says no, too much time went by.
And that's what I'm getting to.
It was just a few seconds.
Okay. If they would have tried to tase him because he said no, it's no guarantee that those prongs wouldn't have hit Mr. Pelosi as well.
I get your point.
They were too close together.
No,
they were
side by side.
I understand what you're saying.
it was not like where you see in the movies where a person is holding a person by the neck, you know, and they got them in front of them, you know, and the hammer in the other hand. It wasn't that. They were side by side. So any officer that had a taser out, which I'm not sure if they did or didn't, but I'm just saying that the moment you saw a weapon in someone's hands at a location that you were called to, if you have your taser out, not necessarily a gun, but a taser, you know, we all know the whole thing, what tasers are initially used
okay.
for. But the point I'm saying is that
what you're saying.
And you know this because you're a former officer. But what
but
I'm
let,
saying
let
is
me
this,
give you a
is
different
that if
scenario.
If we look at the video again, the moment he said no, me, I would have tased his ass.
Let me give
right
you a different
there.
Scenario.
It was, really wasn't
because
a lot.
Hold on, everybody. I think you're kind of missing my point. He still
no,
was
I
able
understand
to strike
your point,
the man.
Right?
He was still able to strike the man in the head.
But what if the person yelling no? What if the person yelling no was actually the homeowner who didn't want to let go of the hammer because he was in fear the other person
right.
was going to strike him with
it.
And then they tased the homeowner.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You no. I think that the fact that where if you're looking at the where there's somebody who doesn't have a weapon and someone that does, I'm going to strike the person who has the weapon. After I ask you, let me finish.
Well, both
and then
have
I'll let both of y'all. And then there's hold on, please. I'm sticking to my story, and then you can say what you think. I get what you're saying, Officer Crenshaw. What if it was the homeowner and he apprehended the person who came into his house? Okay. Now, granted, obviously we know that the individuals or the officers didn't know who Nancy Pelosi's husband was, what he looked like, or this, that, and the other. I get that part. You know, you don't know who is who. So you're stuck between the crosshairs or a rock and a hard place. But I do feel like if there's someone that has a potential weapon towards either party, whether it be the person who said, hey, look, I got the guy. I managed to get the hammer out of his hand, and this is him, take him to jail, or vice versa. The moment that the cops come and you tell them, drop the hammer, and they say no, well, if you're the homeowner, you should be more than welcome to say, here, I'll hand it to you. Fine. I'm glad to see you guys. Okay? That's what you would think.
You would think
that's
that
you
unless
think.
The person
you
that
think
you're
it.
Fighting
you,
for
you,
the
you,
hammer
you,
with.
And that's what you're telling me. Is that if that was the other way around, you're sharing a hypothetical situation which that could have happened. But still, and again, if I ask you to put the hammer down and I'm law enforcement and you refuse to put it down at that point, no, I'm going to tase your fucking ass. You're going to get tased. If you are the victim and you took that hammer from that person and I say, okay, I'm here, I'm law enforcement. You called me? Are you the one who called me? Cool. Put the, you know, I have my guns. I have my taser and everything. Everything's cool. But the moment you tell me no, I'm going to tase you too. I'm going to tase you.
But he said no, and then he lunged because he snapped the hammer out. I mean, this was a few seconds. You think it's minutes, but it wasn't.
I didn't say minutes. I said that
but
the moment
he
said no,
he snapped the hammer out, and all Pelosi started going to away. He lunged right after he snapped the hammer. He lunged. That's how he was able to hit him in the head and fell on top of him. He didn't get a chance to do anything
well,
else because
think,
the police
think,
was
think,
right behind
I
him
think that
and handcuffed him.
And I understand your point. I understand your point, Janet. And the thing is that right, you're right. He did lunge, but maybe I'm looking at the time frame differently than you, of where still at the point of saying no, there was too much time that went by, in my opinion now, that went by where the officers could have reacted. Let me go ahead and open up another microphone here and another guest who's joining us. And I'm very thankful that this gentleman is calling in because we're going to talk about what we all saw last night. I want to wrap this whole part about the Nancy Pelosi thing up. It's interesting what you guys are saying, different points of view of what had occurred. But the mic is open for a gentleman who's had a great show. Unfortunately, he's decided to stop his show, but I'm thankful that he's joined us because he said that he's been reached out by many networks to chime in on the recent incident. And that will be Officer Mason. Officer Mason, thank you for chiming in. How you doing, sir?
Hey, how is everybody? If I can, real quick, I came in on the tail end of the Pelosi thing. And one of the things, and Officer Crenshaw mentioned, and that you mentioned, in that video, we have to understand, first off, those officers knew exactly whose house they were going to. I can guarantee you, if you look at the CAD, which is the computer notes, or listen to the radio traffic, I am quite sure they knew that was Nancy Pelosi's house. That was put out. I guarantee they knew. And one of the things, and Mike, it's like you said, they had a taser, they have guns, or escorts. This is one of the things that's lost in policing. When Officer Crenshaw and I were out there, put your hands on people. You don't always need a weapon or a tool. When you put a tool in your hand, that hand is occupied. You cannot use it. They could have lunged at him and put two hands on him and in the process controlled that individual. I'm not going to second guess what they did or didn't do, should or shouldn't have done. But policing today, officers have forgotten how to put those hands on people, grab them, control them. Then you can go to an impact weapon or a medium force weapon or spray or whatever after that. But you get one
good
shot
point
with a taser. Put your hands on people. Two officers could control that man, which leads into where we're getting into in the next topic. Once you have somebody under physical control, you don't have to exert blows and force and tasers and all these other things. They could have plenty of time. When he said no, that's a cue. It's not a go. It's not a no to react and go. It's a cue. And your mind should be circulating in that moment, and we operate quickly in the moment. I need to make a decision. And you should be moving forward to that guy, not standing in your same place after he says no. And there's
exactly
a 1 to 2 second window where everybody's thinking who's going to do what next. See, you
exactly
could have closed that gap in 1 to 2 seconds, put some hands on him. At that point, you'll be able to identify the victim because the victim will get away from you, will move away from the conflict, and the aggressor will continue to fight you. You'll know. And you're talking about an old man and a middle-aged man. That old man is the least of your threats. You can put your hands on people, and that doesn't mean punch. It means grabbing. Control the weapon hand. If you control the weapon hand, you're controlling 60% of the threat. And that's what should have been
done.
Let
me ask you this question, though, sir, but I have to ask you this, and you know, that makes a good point because, see, here's the thing. I've been fortunate that I've been to I've been down in South Georgia to the training camp there. You know what I'm talking about. Glenn, what's it called? You guys know. I've been there, and my ex, her son was he was graduating, in fact, that day from that location to become a corrections officer. And we were fortunate to see, to peek into some of the rooms where they were doing hands-on training. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. It was very interesting to see where, you know, I've seen where, you know, where they were attacked by two people and how to defend themselves towards two people. Is this something of where officers now feel like the first line of defense is okay, maybe the taser, but if necessary, I'll use the gun, you know, type thing based on what you just said or what you just shared. You know,
right.
Is the training at stake here? Because I know they're trained in hand-to-hand combat, but we don't see that much anymore when there's hand-to-hand combat. I see some officers that look like, you know, I could take them out, and I'm only a buck 50.
But it's not the academy. I think the academies do a good job. The problem is when you get into your field training programs, depending on what field training officer you get, like anything, some are good, some are bad. You'll get some that will tell you when you get in the car, forget everything you learned in the academy, I'm going to teach you. Now, that officer is trying to get through his 3 months and 6 months probation and make the team. So if you have a training officer and that's all he or she does, they resort to the taser, they go to the baton, they don't de-escalate, they don't know how to conversate with people, they're heroes, they profile, that troop will emulate that. And then people will say, well, they didn't, you know, the academy didn't teach them well. No, the academy taught them well. The problem is the field training. And I see a lot of officers today, some of them are huge guys, and you know, I work around a lot of them, and you know, I look at some guys and I can tell they're big guys, but just by the way they talk, they're going to talk their way into something with somebody. And I don't care how much you bench press, you can't pull that piece of lead up off of you when it comes out. See, de-escalation and conversation with people and understanding that you're not a hero, you're not God's gift to law enforcement and the community, you're a person doing a job. And you go into the neighborhood, don't try to change your neighborhood. Go in there and learn that neighborhood. Learn how, learn what's expected. And then once you do that, guess what? When the guys you work with won't back you for whatever reason, that community will watch your back. I'm living proof of it.
So am I.
And they'll tell you who the dirty
so am I.
Yeah, you
and
know what?
Right.
Mr. Crenshaw can contest to that and agree with that. Is that where, you know, I spoke with both you gentlemen prior to today's show, and both of you said the same thing. You got to know the community. As officers, you got to get to know the community, right? Mm-hmm. Officer Crenshaw, what is your response to that, what Officer Mason just said?
He's right. You know, it's not the training at the academy. They teach you the basic principles of law enforcement, legal analysts, articulation of reports, uniform codes, ordinances. They teach you the things that the average person doesn't know. They teach you your hand-to-hand. But the problem is, since they're getting the money for all these different things they're asking for, tasers, aspatons, pepper gas, the policies change. They don't want them to put their hands on anybody anymore to control them and end the fight quickly, because they tell you, well, if you do this, I can't cover you because we gave you that to do this. So you got all the back gadgets around your waist.
Yep.
And you have to make decisions on which back gadget you're going to pull out and use. And if you're going to use it in accordance to the way they taught you at the academy, if you go up and confront somebody and you go to do an armed takedown move on them and they snatch away from you, what did you just do? You let them create a gap to where they have an advantage over you now. You move on in and you grab them and you take them down. You don't have to punch them. You don't have to kick them. You don't have to tase them. But you got officers who are afraid to put hands on because the supervisors and the administration have told them that you need to use your taser and learn how to articulate why you use this taser or why you use that pepper gas. So in the process that I'm thinking about, well, I got to be able to articulate and write down why I pulled my taser, they forget common sense.
And
they forget it.
if I can interject in what he's saying, it's a good point, because these are things you all don't know. When people go get tasers, for instance, when a city gets a contract with Taser International, and Taser International gives a blueprint lesson plan, and they say as long as you follow our lesson plan and recommendations, if you deploy the Taser and go to court, we'll send a representative. And so most departments will follow Taser's plan. But this is some of the things they tell you with a Taser. Is if somebody is sprayed with mace or tear gas, whatever you want to call it, mace, some forms of that are flammable. And one of our rules was if somebody has been sprayed, do not deploy a Taser, even though our mace was not flammable. You never know what somebody else with other agencies use. And depending on cologne, there's a lot of different things. There's a lot more that comes with Taser simply than just pull the trigger and shock them. And the Taser, right. Those prongs, as Officer Finshaw said, those prongs do not come out 1 inch apart. They're 1 inch about when they come out. And they're spreading at about 3 feet. They've already spread 12 inches at 3 feet. When you get to 6 feet, you know, they're about, you know, 2 feet apart, maybe 18 inches to 2 feet apart. So you're not always going to have a 1 inch or 2 inch gap where people see. That doesn't always work. Now, what could have been done, you can rush forward and stick that Taser on somebody and shock them without the prongs coming out. But, you know, there's a lot of things that come with the Taser, and we see so many videos of people tased, and I look at them, and I know that most of those are violation of Taser International's policies, not department, but Taser International's policies. Don't tase anybody in a vehicle that's running. Don't tase anybody on a bicycle. Anybody on an elevated surface, on stairs, on a ladder, standing up on the edge of a porch. You don't tase them, but we see it all the time in videos, and you guys don't know that that's tasers against their recommendations and many department policies, and the media doesn't know, so nobody catches that. But the officers know when they see it.
Right.
Ooh, that was bad.
Right. That's very interesting. I quickly want to say that, well, the board is filling up. I see some folks here on the board that are listening. Thank you guys for chiming in. I have some folks here. I'm pretty sure they have some questions or comments. Another officer may be chiming in shortly. But you guys know that you can hit the number one so I can open up your mic when you're ready to comment. But I really want to get the officers to share what's going on. So I want to now move to what we all saw last night. If all of you saw it, this was one of the most horrendous beatings and really considered now a murder we've ever seen of any individuals by police. People are comparing this to the Rodney King beating. I reached out to Laura King, which she's been a guest on the show a couple of times. I didn't ask her to be a guest on the show. I asked her to listen in if she could, you know, and maybe we could get her to come on a later date. But because I'm pretty sure she's getting phone calls. As you said, Officer Mason, you've been reached, many networks have reached out to you to share, and I'm very honored and blessed that you chose to come on this show and share. I want to go to Officer Crenshaw first. When you saw this video, what was your first reaction?
Well, first I want to give my condolences to Tyreek Nichols' family because it shouldn't have never happened. Me and my wife was watching it, and I started crying. In all my years, I've never seen anything like that on the police end of it. First thing came to my mind was they were beating him as if they were jumping him in or out of a gang, passing him around, punching him, kicking him. In over 30 years, I've never seen officers act that way. I've seen officers go overboard, run up and kick somebody. I've never seen them, never, holding punching, kicking, stomping, hitting with an ass baton. And the whole time they're doing it, which it frustrates me, the whole time they're doing it, they're yelling what the academy used to teach back in the day before cameras, because they figured if you're fighting with someone or you have to shoot someone, nobody is going to see what's going on. Nobody can see. Nobody's around. At least they heard you. Show me your hand. Put your hands behind your back. But at the same time, they're pulling them in five different directions. You got five people yelling at him, pulling him in five different directions. He can't do what they want him to do. And they weren't trying to let him. And it just pisses me off, because I told my wife, I said, you know what, I was so proud to be a retired police officer. Made it through, did it. My dad was the first black bus driver here in Atlanta for MARTA. I wanted to work for the city. I came back. I worked with the city of Atlanta, you know. And I can't even hold my head up in pride and say I'm a retired police officer, because nobody's going to remember the officer I was and how I was on the street, dealing with the neighborhoods, getting to know the community knowing me, respect and trust being built. They're going to say retired police, and the first thing they're going to visualize is this nickel situation.
Now, you and I talked about that earlier, and, you know, like I said, there's a lot of folks who said they hate the cops, period, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be this situation. They always had that mindset. They hate every cop, you know, based on, as you said, their experience with, doesn't matter if they were black or white. And again, I want to say that a lot of folks say that this is not a black or white situation, which I'm going to get to Officer Mason about. This is a culture within the police departments now. Am I right? So this is what, you know, is going on. There's so much we could talk about on this, but I don't want you to feel that way, my brother. I respect you as an officer. You've been a great officer. I remember when you were on COPS, all the episodes. I remember that there was never anything that showed any bias or anything that you did wrong. You as a human being, I know you as my friend. You know, you're a good guy. Excuse me. I didn't expect that cough to come. But you were doing your job. And there are cops out there that do their job. But unfortunately, this happened. I want to go to Officer Mason, get him to chime in on this whole thing that I just said to Officer Crenshaw. What was your thoughts when you saw that video? You know, immediately, what did you think? Because I think you shared with me that you saw this coming, and not necessarily a black thing or a white thing, just the culture of policing. Am I correct?
And you know, like Officer Crenshaw, my heart went out to the family. And, you know, I did my 25 years in policing, retired for 3 years, and went back into it. And I enjoyed, I mean, working in a different area. I'm not working the streets, but my thing and my show has always been, when the majority of these incidents we saw were white officers or black suspects, I said plenty of times on my show, well, where are the black officers? You work in these departments. By the time you reach your third or fourth year, you know who's rotting on your shift and who's not. You know who's rotting in these special units and who's not. Yeah. And when we have police unions and we have officers unions and whatever, and you don't have officers in there speaking up about these things, and there's been a long period to where the black officers collectively in a lot of departments have not spoken up about this. So I was not surprised that the officers were black that did it. I really wasn't, because we are not dealing, the media views this as a black-white thing. And I've said since 2016, this is a culture thing. It is the blue culture. I, as a citizen, the citizen side of me, refuse to hear one more speech or one more politician say, well, as the community, we have to learn how to do. No, we don't have to learn anything. They're the ones paid to go to training that taxpayers paid for. The community does not have to learn how to deal with the police. The police need to learn how to deal with the community. So flipping the script and throwing it on the community, that lie holds no water. The second thing is, in many of these departments, you do have racism. And I think that we, as black people, we have to stop shouldering the burden of dialogue. Even within black officers, even within these departments where you have some of these things going on, we have to stop being willing to go to the table and discuss these issues. You know what? First, you go with your people, get your people together. Then you come to the table when I think you have an understanding of the problem. Because I'm living proof. You know, as a police officer who spoke up about police brutality, I don't care if you're black, white, pink, or black, and taught people their rights, and this is how you file complaints to do this and do that. I was despised within my department and many people in the city, city officials, but I was loved by that community. But there weren't a whole bunch of officers, white or otherwise, beating down my door supporting me.
Let me ask you this question, and gentlemen, I have to interject on this because based on the video that we saw, I have some questions here, and I'm sure some of the panel, or I'm sorry, the co-hosts have some. I have one here, and Janet, I want you to chime in and ask some questions. We're going to take a music break shortly and then come back to this conversation, this topic. This is very interesting. This is very important. We do have another individual I have scheduled for the last part of the show, but seeing how long this is going, I want to make sure everybody has a chance to respond, and we have it. And I hope that the individual that I have scheduled will understand that this might go a little bit longer because this is a very important conversation. Because as it was mentioned, this is looked at a racial issue. Every major city was preparing for riots, outbreaks, and all kinds of stuff, protests. Yes, there were protests. But this is different to a certain extent. This is kind of different. Officer Mason, you said that where it's not the first time we've seen it. We've seen this many a times. We just didn't recognize it, right? We really didn't.
Yes, sir.
That this has probably been going on for a long time, which it has been going on for a long time. We just did not see it in the, I guess, how should I put it, the in the way that we saw with the cameras that we saw, the body cameras, the camera that was at that particular intersection. Think about the fact that where the final part of this thing went down at an intersection where they had a camera that the city, you know, posted here. They're able to zoom into everything what these officers did. Had that camera not been there, we would never have known. We would never have seen what had occurred. With that happening there, I want to ask you two as officers. Body cams were initially introduced to show, you know, to be open and to be transparent about what happens in a stop. This was a normal traffic stop like any other traffic stop. Just a traffic stop. And unfortunately, we've seen so many cases and so many videos of people who were basic, normal traffic stop who lose their lives. And there's body cameras. So my question is, does this really help? I mean, because it's like where it don't matter. Some officers are going to do what they want to do regardless.
And that's where the hiring and the screening process needs to be more effective. You know, a traffic stop is probably the most dangerous thing that an officer can do because you're approaching a vehicle that you have no idea who's inside. You have no idea what's inside. Now, the way from the video I watched last night, unless they had been doing surveillance on him or targeting him as an area, someone, a drug dealer, a gangbanger or something in a high crime area, it was no reason why they should have ran up on that car the way that they did and snatched him out like they did.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, if he's driving reckless, he could be DUI. You know, he could be having a stroke, insulin attack, anything. So you still approach with caution. The way they ran up on him was like they were targeting him and had to get him out the car because they know he was going to take off in the car.
Mm. Wow.
So they
okay,
were doing what the specialized units normally do. They call them jump outs. They were doing what they normally do. You know, but it all falls back on administration and supervision. You know,
mm-hmm.
people would say all the time, oh, you write me a ticket because you got a quota. Well, no, I don't have a quota. I don't have to bring in 15 tickets. I don't have to bring in 10 tickets. But your supervisors would normally tell you, you need to go out and make some cases. They're not telling you what cases to make or how many to make. They're just saying your performance is down in what you do. And I would argue
which
with them all day long.
Well, that goes back to the argument of a quota of where you're pretty much saying, so you're telling me I have to have a quota, you know, because see,
well,
here's another thing. And what you mentioned something
change.
I found interesting, but here's something that you mentioned I found interesting when you said, and I definitely want to put this in here. This squad was known as the Scorpion Squad here in Atlanta, which Officer Crenshaw, you know, they used to have what they called the Red Dog, right? Which
right.
handles certain drug cases. All of them were unmarked vehicles. So anybody being pulled over or and I know they probably put on their blue lights and everything, but that should be a shock to anybody. All of a sudden, here's a vehicle. You've seen regular individuals who have unmarked cars or their personal cars who play cop, you know. So you would be kind of cautious of pulling over if there's something that don't say Cobb County cop or whatever, and they got blue lights. So what? That doesn't mean you're a cop. And people are very cautious about that type of approach nowadays. There's a lot of fake
right.
individuals. Okay. There's a lot of cases that we've seen or read about folks who have done this before and who have taken people, not necessarily into custody, but taken them and killed. But the part I'm saying is that where, you know, this Scorpion Squad, which I've just read, that now is disbanded, okay? Let's look at the time that these officers have been in this particular unit. From what I've read, some have only been a year or two. I want both
a
of
year,
you to speak
that's
on.
On the department. That's a year
right.
to 3 years on the department. They shouldn't, have no business working a specialized unit. They haven't even learned how to work the streets.
Correct.
They don't know the people of the streets.
Right, and the neighborhoods and everything. So I want Officer Mason to chime in on that. What's your thoughts about that for a person who just basically came out of the academy, just basically got out of training, basically gone through probation, being put into such a very serious unit that deals with drugs and everything and being put on the streets in that manner?
Mike, first off, let's understand what these so-called specialized units are up front. Now, with the exception of your SWAT team or emergency service team, whatever you want to call them, with the exception of SWAT teams, specialized unit UC is formed to produce statistics.
Exactly.
Yes, you can say we made arrests and we've got this many guns or this much drugs, but primarily they're made to produce statistics. And if you look at many of these specialized units, they're underfunded by grants. Grants demand statistics to justify the grant. So who do statistics help? They don't help that man or woman on the street. Whether I write, whether Stan goes out and writes 25 tickets a week or not, I'm getting paid the same amount of money. Statistics to present to city council. See, they need statistics. The officers don't need them. So then when you take these units, and most of the time, they're not made up of the best of the best in the department, because a lot of the best officers in the department don't want to put up with being in a specialized unit. Then they're treated like glory boys and girls. They're given the best uniforms, the best training, specialized equipment, the flexible schedule. They can get weekends and holidays off. Most of your so-called specialized units aren't out there on Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve when the patrol officers are. So let's get an understanding of, with the exception of SWAT, let's get an understanding of these specialized units. And then how do we, where do we get these people from? Well, gee, we go down to patrol that's already stretched to the limit and undermanned.
Right.
So we need 20 people for a specialized unit. Guess where those 20 people come from? Patrol. And what does the chief always promise? Oh, we'll replace them out of the next academy class with what, the five people in the academy? So now your response time to regular calls is way down. Then your officers are out there working calls and reports and accidents and all this other stuff they have. And your specialized units are sitting over there at the coffee shop for 40, 45 minutes, maybe an hour, go out, make a few stops, make some noise, go back to the office, sit down, take their vest off, sit under the air conditioner, and the patrol officers are out there busting their ass. Now, anybody who's been in patrol, I dare them to call and say, I'm not telling the truth. And then we give them these names like Scorpion, Snake, Red Dog. Oh, those are still appealing. What does the name tell you about the service in the community?
That crossed my mind. It's like, you know, I mean, you got to put this type of name. Is that supposed to invoke fear to the criminals or what? Because I think that invokes fear to the neighborhood in a sense, not to the criminals.
So where was the chief when the name was developed or when the chief took over and the name was there? Why didn't the chief demand a change? Where are you, Mr. City Manager? Certainly you heard of this unit. You hear their stats at the city council meeting. You had no problem with their statistics. But I guarantee you if the Scorpion unit or the Red Dog unit or any other unit came in your neighborhood and acted the way they did in the hood, all you council people would have an issue with it. See, we're talking about the culture.
Right. Let me go ahead and open up this other mic. I have another guest to chime in, an officer also. And I appreciate you calling in. Officer Harper, how you doing, sir?
Hey, I'm doing very well. The two gentlemen, the retired gentlemen that are officers, and I'm still on the street. I got two more years left. You're speaking the truth. Just to reiterate on what you just concluded on with the officers being pulled from patrol, and they said they're not the best officers, and they're just out there to get statistics and numbers and stats. That is so very true. Because our SWAT team is supposed to be your elite team, but what it does is leave the precincts manned, unmanned. So what he was speaking upon about the response times, we're even having problems with our fire medics. We have people dying because we can't get ambulances and fire trucks to their residency in time. They got to come from another side of town, so we lose that time. Our response times, we're dealing with domestic issues, assaults, homicides. We can't even get to the next car, and they have to wait because we don't have other officers to move. The way they got out of that car, the way they approached Mr. Nichols, my observation, and from so many things that we have seen in law enforcement, black-on-black crime, or was this somebody that they targeted or knew from a previous occasion? Because we as officers just don't pounce on people. And I think Officer Crenshaw said a traffic stop is one of the most deadly encounters that all of us law enforcement have. So you don't know who you're approaching, what kind of weapons they have in the car, and what they're going to do with that car. So to come out on that car, I'm wondering if it's personal or was it personal? Did they know him from a previous engagement? And since they were traveling in numbers, this was the opportunity for them to take control while they had that uniform on, which they thought gave them extra power. It's just a uniform.
Right.
We're out here to serve
right.
and protect and take care of these
people. I agree with that to a certain extent because I look at it where when I looked at the video and I saw that, you know, where he was compliant, though.
Yes.
He was compliant. He's like, and he asked one simple question. What are you stopping me for? And we see this too many times where the citizen has the right to ask the question. The citizen
and we're
has
supposed
the right.
to give him the answer first. Like, if
exactly.
you ask me, what am I stopping you for?
Sir,
you ran a red light.
Happened.
So we'll get that out of the way.
Yeah,
now you know the reason.
I've seen too many videos, you guys, and I'm sure you have too, where when the citizen asks a question, the officer says, well, I need you to step out the car, and I'll tell you why. No, you need to tell me now.
You know, my
the simple thing that could have done was telling him what he was, in every case, the simplest thing, if you're getting stopped, the officer is stopping you for a reason. It should not be a guessing game. It should not be a... Well, you know what? Well, I'm stopping you, and I'm not going to tell you why until you step out the car.
And, Mike, and to your answer, though, that it's so simple because there is actually the International Chiefs of Police, actually, it's not a ironclad rule, but they actually came up with what's known in some places as the five-step violator contact, in others, the seven-step violator contact.
Mm-hmm.
It is actually a program that we are taught.
Mm-hmm.
To de-escalate when we walk up, hi, I'm Officer Mason, Waco PD or whatever, and the reason I'm stopping you today is because of whatever.
That's right.
Do you have this?
Right.
And it's iron. If you follow that, look at all these videos that we see that end up with officer arguing at the car. If you would simply had done those things, I'm Officer Mason.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. The reason I'm stopping you today is you failed to stop at the stop sign back there. No, blah, blah, blah. Well, I'm just telling you why. If you haven't tried, people will comply with that. 80% probably would.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
when you don't tell them, give me what I asked for, and then I'll tell you. And it's really important that your listeners have reference points. So I want them to Google that. Five or seven
mm-hmm.
step violator contact for traffic stops. Google it and read it. Also Google Sir Robert Peel. P-E-E-L. He is considered the founding father of modern-day policing in America. Read his 9 tenets. Some places call it the Peelian principle, or you can just Google the 9 tenets of policing, Robert Peel. You will read exactly what Sir Robert Peel said officers should do. And he wrote the program of policing for the English, and we adopted it over here as the earliest form of a policing doctrine. But if people will read that, they'll learn such things as, does the citizen have to respect me as an officer just because I have a badge and a gun? And so Robert Peel said, no, it is not the responsibility of the citizen to respect the officer. It is the officer's responsibility to earn that citizen's respect.
Mm-hmm.
Earn
it. That's
earn it. The best way to de-escalate any situation is not to escalate it. If you
right.
walk
exactly.
up kind and polite and professional, 9 out of 10 people is going to be kind, polite, and professional. They're probably not going to like you anyway because they don't like police
right.
or whatever, but they're not going to give you a hard time.
Right.
Especially if you talk
Let me
to
do
them
this real
the way you would want somebody to talk to your family.
Let me do this real quick. I want to give us a quick breather, a music break, okay? And we'll come back. And we'll wrap this up because I have a question, and then I'm sure that Janet may have some questions or comments, or anybody else on the board. I see there's some other folks on the board. I appreciate all three of you officers chiming in this evening, especially after what we watched. We've seen some horrific videos, but to see, I mean, I'm just saying, for me, to see what these five black officers did to a young black man, you know, it's kind of different. It's kind of different. And I think it was Officer Mason. Well, I already said this, but they said that, well, you know, it doesn't matter the color. It's the culture. It's the culture. So let's take a quick music break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the TMGS, the Michael Gay Show on the Michael Gay Network. We'll be right back, you guys.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother,
what's up?
This is a stupid party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig
it. Right on. Hey, man, what's your name?
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and here today. Oh, pick it light. It's fine. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Michael Gay Show, broadcasting live from the ATL, Atlanta, Georgia, with my co-host Janet Davis, here with me, Officer Jeffrey Crenshaw. We have special guest Officer Mason, and Officer Harper is here with us, and I'm thankful and honored to have all of you here on the show. I know Janet is standing by and wanting to ask a question. I think Cotton Campbell, the host of Let's Talk About It, which will air this coming Sunday night at, I believe it's at 10 p.m. Eastern, or is it 9? I have to confirm that, but Let's Talk About It, great show here on the TMGN, will be on this coming Sunday night. So they changed their time frame. So based on what we've seen, and it's not really much we can really elaborate on it, what it is what it is. It's sad to see. Officer Crenshaw, Officer Mason, both of you have over 20 years as officers. You have been speaking about police reform, things that you've experienced as both. both of you said, you got to know the neighborhood. You got to know the people in the neighborhood. Obviously, you guys had that opportunity. Get to know the people. Let the people get to know you. Who's dropping the ball here? When you look at some of these officers, we're just all of a sudden put into a situation with just a year or two of experience, not really experience in the street of being an officer. And what do you recommend these police departments do moving forward? I'll let Officer Crenshaw speak first.
Well,
because they really need your knowledge. One
thing they need to do is the officers that are actually patrolling the streets are the ones that need to go and sit in the communities and talk with the residents, talk with the people in the communities, not somebody who's sitting up in an office that schedules, I can come out on Tuesday at 3 o'clock and have a community meeting, because he's going to get all the information, take it back up to headquarters. It's not going to get to the officers. Those people are not going to get to know. When they call 911, that's not the face that's going to show up. The face that's going to show up is the officer that's working the streets. And that's who they need to get. He's got to earn their trust and respect. I would tell people all the time when I was training them, wherever you live, when you cross into the city limits of Atlanta, you are in their home. Not at their door. You're in their home.
Right.
This is where they spend their money at. You spend your money on whatever side of town you live on. This is their home. Give them respect in their home. And I would say that because I grew up there. My mother was there before she passed, my brothers and sisters. And I wanted to treat people the way I wanted my family treated. When my mother called me one day and asked me, does all officers cuss at everybody for no reason? I lost my damn mind. When she told me who the officer was, I went to him face to face. And Officer Mason's correct. There is a procedure and a policy. When you approach a vehicle, when you knock on somebody's door, you don't walk up. If you call me again, I'm taking you both to jail. That don't solve anything. You have to listen first. 90% of the people that call, even the aggressor, just wants to be heard. They want to get their side out. And if officers would learn to do that and stop thinking that they're superhuman because they have a badge and a gun, 65% of them never been in a fight before a day in their life. They only took the job because it was paying more than another job was. And it was hiring a lot quicker. But the administration's got to get off their high horse and quit worrying about statistics and numbers, because they threaten the officer sometimes. The officer doesn't have a quota, but if he don't do something, he won't get the off days that he wants. He won't get the shift that he wants. I used to argue with him all the time and I would tell my supervisor, that person who wrote those 20 tickets, he got 20 tickets. I got one. Go look at how many fucking 911 calls he answered. He's got three. I got 45. I went to 45 calls because he was out trying to get you the numbers that you wanted so you can present them up the chain so you can apply for the funding that you want for what's not even being used towards me. Because I'm going to get the same pay whether I write one ticket or 50 tickets.
Right. I got to quickly go through, and I'm sorry, I didn't really mean to cut you short, but I want to go ahead because we're going to be running out of time. But you're on point. That whole thing works with pretty much a lot of jobs, in a sense. But I see exactly what you're talking about. Officer Mason, what's your thoughts, your final thoughts on this? What can
I'll be real quick with it. I think that before we worry about the officers, you need to start lighting some city managers' asses up, because that's the police chief's boss. And then start lighting up your council people who come to the church and give you a good spiel and take selfies with you and then go back there and sit silent and watch a lot of BS happen. And the reason I'm going to say that is I challenge everybody listening to this show, go get a copy of your police budget. Go look at expenditures. Now, why is it every time one of these happens, cities across America are bracing for protest? Look at the amount of money spent on officer overtime, officers called in, extra resources called in. We spend more time preparing for the catastrophe than preventing the catastrophe. We've always got a budgetary reason why we can't have a power program. It's too much money. A reach out program. It's too much money. We don't want to pay the officers 2 hours a day or 2 hours a week overtime to go to the Boys and Girls Club and work out or work with the kids. We don't want to pay them that. That's too much city money. Look at what we just spent on that protest in downtown Atlanta, an APD officer overtime, the Fulton County overtime.
Right.
A lot of things can be not necessarily, I'm not saying for that particular incident because there are a lot of different dynamics in it, but a lot of things can be prevented. Policing and the organization or institution of policing is not able to do an autopsy on itself and say we did bad at this, and cities don't know how to do it. And city managers are never thrown the bus, only the chief and the officers. Well, the city manager is the police chief's boss. Light their ass up. Wow. Go protest down there at his office and not at City Hall sometime. Go protest.
You know, that's a good point. That is a very great point, because just like whenever there's a, you know, a case against, you know, the city based on a wrongful death and everything, that comes, you know, that money comes out of the community budget, right? You know, I mean, you know, if there's something wrong and they have to settle out of court, per se, that comes out of the taxpayers' money, you know. And I like what you just said about where the preparation for what might happen, the money that goes into that, when the money should go towards different things to prevent it. That's a damn good point. That's a damn good point. Officer Harper, are you still here?
Yes, I'm still
Officer
here. I'm
Mayor.
Working crowd control right now, so I'm just listening. I'm listening.
Okay. Do you want to share your last thoughts on this conversation?
Yeah, I would just want to say I think where we're losing it, I was once an academy instructor as well, is in the academy. Right now the police academy has turned into a lighter side of sports. There's no discipline. Everybody gets a timeout. Every time you're hurt, you can just back up. You don't have to go through the measurements, the true measurements of an officer, all the way back to the screening. We're accepting anybody because we need numbers. And with these special units, there is a lack of training. And the people who are in our department, you have to be here at least 3 to 4 years to even be considered to be able to sign up for a special unit. And those special units are officers coming from the precinct without the appropriate training. The funding, we're not spending money on proactive, we're spending money on reactive. Like, why should we be spending money on officers doing overtime because we're doing riot control versus spending money on officers to understand what people need in the community? When I'm training on the street, I usually tell my officers, let's park the car. I work the project. They're like, park the car? I say, yeah. They were like, we're going to get out and walk? I say, yeah. We're going to interact with the community. You don't know people by riding through the neighborhood with your window cracked, and the only time they see your face is when you're jumping out on an incident. Walk those streets. Talk to the community. And I heard, I think, Officer Mason said something about community meetings. You have to attend the meetings, see what the people want, and don't bring those statistics just to the office. If they give you time in roll call, if they're still having roll call, share it with all the other officers you work with. Somebody needs to take minutes, but nobody wants to pay for those extra minutes for an officer for training. So we have to invest in our officers up front. Not reactive, be proactive. Let's see what we need in the beginning. Let us walk these streets. Let us talk to the community. That's all I really have to say. We need to be in these streets, feet on the ground, boots on the ground, not in the car.
I truly agree with you. I truly look at it that way. I've known maybe two officers in my lifetime that I would see on a regular basis, and they would interact with the community. Fortunately, I've met you officers because, of course, you're interacting with us right now, and that's so important, you know what I mean, and so important to the show and hopefully to all the listeners. Janet Davis, my right hand here for the TMGN Network. I know you've been sitting back listening to all this conversation. What's your question or comments to our guests before we move on to a more lighter topic?
Well, I just feel I agree with all the officers on everything that they said and we talked about. The whole thing was a heinous act. From the time they pulled Tyree out of the car, beat him, stabbed him, not stabbed him, but tased him, sprayed him. You know, if he hadn't ran away, he probably would have died right there on the scene. And the other thing is the mother, when she said she had pains in her stomach, by me being a mother, I know what she meant. Because when one of my children, something happens to someone close to me, I also get feelings of dread that something is wrong. And
right.
I wanted to mention that the EMTs that was on the scene that didn't respond like they should have, they've been relieved of duty until further investigation.
Yeah, there's so many things going on with this this case, so many things that I hope, I'm not going to say I hope that with this, there will be a lot of police reform throughout the country. I mean, it's unbearable to see this happening, knowing that it's going to happen again. Like Officer Mason had said to me earlier, he had mentioned on his show a while back, there'll be another Rodney King situation, and people are comparing this to Rodney King. Fortunately, Rodney King lived through it. But unfortunately, Tyree Nichols is dead. Unfortunately, this young man is dead, a father. What his mother said was so profound. So, I mean, my eyes welled up when I heard her speak and I saw the video. I welled up. And we all have to kind of like well up and cry in a sense, because this could have been our son. When you really think about it, this could have been our son. This could have been anybody's child over a traffic violation. Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for chiming in this Saturday and sharing it. Love for all of you to come back, hopefully not to talk about an incident like this, but to talk about doing something in the communities, helping educate, which you've done so far this evening. You've educated us about a lot of things. And, you know, let folks know that not all officers are bad, but the bad ones need to go. And like Officer Mason said, we got to go towards our government. We got to go towards our city managers. We got to go towards everybody who's at the top of the chain and let them know we're not happy with this. You got to change this. This should have never happened, and it should never happen again whatsoever. Our tax dollars are being spent for the wrong reasons. Our tax dollars should be for helping our community, and not defending officers, not paying off, you know, for lawsuits and shit like that. That's where a lot of it goes. You know what I'm talking about. Can you imagine how many lawsuits are out there in just your city alone? Millions of dollars that can go towards your community centers, your kids, you know, places where your kids can grow and play, your schools, this, that, and the other. They're shutting down schools all over the country. But there's millions and millions of dollars that are paying on lawsuits because of what an officer did, or, you know, just, I mean, just crazy shit. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you. I really do. I want to. It's kind of hard to do because, as you know, I think I shared this earlier. Is that where, you know, I initially had a whole different show lined up for this Saturday. I really did. It was going to be about, you know, the music industry. I had a bunch of artists lined up that were coming on, and we're going to chime in and share some stuff. And once I heard about these officers being arrested and then having to bail out and everything, I'm like, whoa. And I told Jen, I said, no, we got to change up. So we are rescheduling that particular topic for next Saturday. Hopefully the individuals I had scheduled, Miss Bunny DeBarge from the DeBarge family, was scheduled to chime in. In fact, Bunny was supposed to chime in tonight. She said she was going to, but that's cool. I don't know if she's on the board or not. I have to take a look. Many other folks were scheduled to chime in on that particular topic.
Can I give you a kudo real quick? I mean, this is something, because you never tout your own horn, and so I will. I haven't spoken on police matters for several months. And, you know, I turned down a lot of offers to give my opinion or whatever with these major media talking people. You do the heavy lifting, brother. And I look at, they prop the same police experts up there on all these major talk shows, but they never get to where we are tonight. And it's a true testament to the type of person you are, because most news people don't know one police officer personal, because Officer Crenshaw and the other officer will tell you, if I'm wrong, we usually do not talk to this level with the community. We only do it amongst officers. But the fact that you know, able to reach three of us and get this level of conversation is something major media can't even do. Because we don't usually share a lot of what me and Officer Crenshaw will talk about. You and your audience are now included in what a conversation with me and him would be like, where most of the time we don't talk this way in the community because they can't understand it. But we recognize that the only way they're going to get to understand is if we have a vehicle where we can give our experiences with a host we trust. That's the thing. It's one thing to go on CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and talk and look pretty on TV. But I've watched all these so-called, not one of them went to the level we went to tonight on the problem. Not one. And that's a testament to you, brother, and the heavy lifting you get on the budget that you put in to do the show. So I thank you for being you.
I appreciate that. Truly, I do. I truly appreciate that. I'm just honored and I'm blessed, you know, to know all of you, to just have this platform. Janet Davis is my right hand. She helps put all this all together. All my co-hosts, everyone. I've had many of co-hosts over the years and everything, and so many great guests. But when it comes to something this important, this serious, I think about the people like yourself, like Officer Crenshaw, like Officer Harper, who've been out there, who's still out there. You know, I don't listen to the news. You know, I listen to the people who actually been there. I have a nephew who used to be an officer, and he told me why he quit the force, because of the particular department. He saw that racial thing going on there. He came on the show before. So who could tell you better than the person who experienced it? You know, who could tell you better? So thank you, Officer Mason. I truly appreciate it. I'm going to add a little bit more time, because I definitely want to go ahead and get this topic in. And again, I want to thank you guys, you gentlemen. We all got to come back together again. Again, I'll say, hopefully not under the same circumstances, but for you to continue to educate our listeners because you guys have been out there on the front line and know what's happening on the streets. For the young officers or anyone who has family in the police department, I hope that you share this show. All of our shows are archived. You can go to www.blogtalkradio.com/TMGS and listen to what these gentlemen just shared. Okay? Share it with your friends and family. If this topic comes up, play this show. Listen to what these officers have shared. I'm not going to do a music break. I'm going to go right into it. This gentleman has been waiting patiently because I had scheduled him. I'm sorry, I'm starting to lose my voice. But this gentleman has been waiting patiently. He's been a guest on the show, and I wanted him to come on because, as you all know, the price of every damn thing is going up. Now, I love me some pancakes, right? And normally I would do the Bisquick thing, you know, Bisquick with the eggs and the milk, you know, mix it up and make some pancakes. I can't afford the eggs anymore, so now I got to do the instant crap, add water. But this brother here, you guys probably remember Janet. You remember he was on the show before, and he's Arapus. He raises bees, but also he has chickens, and he has eggs, and he sells the honey, and he sells the eggs. And I was just curious one day. I said, I wonder how is Mr. Edward doing with his sales on chicken eggs? Because trust me, you guys, he's got white, brown, the blue-looking ones and everything. I've ate his eggs. In fact, I need to go by and get some more, you know. But I was wondering, how's his sales going? And the thing is that he and I had a conversation. He was sharing with me some things that you guys might want to know about the chicken egg industry.
And why are your egg prices going up so doggone high, right?
Janet, are you there? Janet? She must have herself on mute.
Yes, I was on mute.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay,
Yes, I've also tried to figure out why eggs are so high and why they have been shrinking. You know, the eggs are not like they were before.
That's very true, too. Without further ado, let me open up his mic and let's welcome our friend. I appreciate him coming back. Maybe he has the answer to this problem, Mr. Edward Morgan. Hello, Mr. Morgan. How are you today, sir? And thank you for being so patient.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me once again. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. All right. That's a term that people will say for months to come. I still say it. But when I run this on somebody I haven't seen since the first part of the year. But yeah, man, people are concerned that the price of a dozen eggs costs more than buying a whole damn chicken. What's going on?
Well, the main thing is the chicken feed. The prices have increased. It used to be something like $18 a bag for a 50-pound bag of chicken feed, and it's gone up to like $23, $24. Depends on the brand and where you buy it. Mainly, I buy my chicken feed from Tractor Supply, but every once in a while, there is a chicken feed store in Henry County. It's like a mill, so they make food for goats, chickens, cows, things like that.
Mm.
You can get it at a cheaper rate, but, you know, I'm not in Henry County every day because I live in Marietta. But that's mainly
right.
The reason that the prices have gone up. The cost, like just like everything else, the cost has gone up quite a bit. So what I've done to fight that when I first started and I didn't know much about chickens, I used to, and I was working a full-time job, I used to put chicken feed in a 55-gallon barrel, and I would have holes at the bottom and just let them eat as much as they wanted, right? But I've decided against that because that becomes costly. So what I do now is I feed them either in the morning or in the afternoon, and I let them out and let them graze on the grass and the bugs and the compost. So that's I just let them out. But I have to really I changed one thing recently. I let them out in the evening because if you let them out too early, the hawks will get them.
Right.
So I'll give them a little feed in the morning, and then I'll let them out in the evening. Since it's getting dark around 7, I'll probably let them out around 5 o'clock. And then, you know, when it gets dark, they automatically go in, so all I have to do is come back and close the gate.
Now, you were saying that the cost of feed went up. Can you share, I mean, do you have an understanding why the cost of feed is going up? Can you share that? I'm pretty sure you know. But why is the cost of feed going up?
To tell you the truth, I don't know. I just know it went up, right? I guess it's just costing more to produce everything. The farmers have to, they're incurring their costs, and they've just raised the prices across the board. But, you know, I have no choice. I just, to get chicken feed, because here's the thing. I'm not a garden farmer. I'm more of a livestock. So some farmers might raise their own corn or wheat or whatever. I'm just buying whatever they have at Tractor Supply. So, you know, between feeding them that chicken feed and the natural grass, that's my model.
Now, you sell your eggs, and as I already said, that where I've had your product, and I was just so impressed. I need to come by and get some more of your eggs and your honey, of course, which we talked about before, but I want you to share for the new listeners or the ones that didn't hear the last time you were on the show, your location, your product. But when it comes to the eggs, your price is, I think you said like $7-$8 for a dozen. Is that right?
Right. I just recently increased the price from $6 to $7, probably about a year ago. Because I know other people that sell eggs. They've been selling theirs at farmers markets, and depending on where you go, at anywhere from $7 to $8. And a couple people told me like a year ago, you're underselling. But, you know, I was keeping my costs down because I didn't have to buy the cartons. I have people, family and friends, and a lot of people that support me. They save the cartons, so I just recycle the cartons. So that keeps. So I raised the price from $6 to $7, and I know people that are selling them for $8 and $9. But if I can get 7 right now, I'm fine with that. I'm not trying to overprice myself because there is a little competition out there. A lot of people are starting to sell their own chicken or buy chickens and raising their own eggs, that type of thing. And I recognize over probably maybe 8 or 9 months ago that I couldn't keep up with the demand. So I bought in September, 100 chickens because I already had about 50. So I bought a
wait a minute, you got over 200. Right. You got over 200 chickens now.
I got about 150.
Okay,
and growing. So what happens is when I bought them as baby chickens in September, it takes months for them to reach the adult stage. So they're just now starting to lay. Like I got like 4 or 5 last week. I got 3 today. But they're just now coming on board. So within the next 30 days, I suspect that I should have anywhere from 10 to 12 dozen every day. And if I had enough chickens, I could actually sell 20 dozen eggs every day.
Wow.
Because what I've done over the years, I would take customers' information. You know, I'd get their telephone number, their name and telephone number, and I would text people. I'm like, hey, I got a dozen today. And so I got about 50 people on my phone now that I can text at any moment and say I got eggs, and they'll come and get them.
Immediately, right. Well,
yeah, and then, you know, I got other people dropping in every day.
Janet, did you have a question or comment, or anybody on the board, if you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yeah,
Mr.
I want to give my... Do you hear me? I'm going to give you my phone number so you can call me, because I'm going to come get eggs. But I also know you sell honey, right?
I do.
Yeah. So can you tell us something about the... your honey and the price of it?
So my honey is considered wildflower honey because the bees go out and collect the nectar, bring it in, bring it back into the beehive and convert the nectar into honey. And it's considered wildflower because they forage on flowers that anywhere from 3 to 5 miles out.
Okay.
So it's considered wildflower. Honey is good for allergies and helps the immune system. And so I sell a 1 pound bottle for $16 and I sell a 2 pound bottle for $30. And I do have a website, so I ship it all over the country. But it's been pretty good. The business has been pretty good. It's between the bees, the goats, and the chickens. Everything is keeping me pretty busy.
Oh, wait a minute now. Wait a minute. Hold on.
What are you doing with the goats?
Put on the brakes. Did you say goats?
Yeah.
I do. Well, I only have 6 right now. But the plan is to breed the goats, because here's the crazy thing. As I was selling the honey and selling the eggs over the last couple of years, I initially bought the goats just to rent out to graze in people's yards, because that's a whole business in itself, renting goats to people that have, let's say, their yard is overgrown with ivy or what's that other thing?
Clovers?
Just weeds.
So you can rent, there's a business where you can rent goats, and the goats will go in there and eat everything in sight. So that was the initial model, and I've rented them out a couple of times. But as people drop in to buy the honey and the eggs, they would see the goats. So I've had Nigerians say, hey, that is a delicacy in my country, and if you started selling goats, I would buy every one of them. And I'm looking at him like, what? And a goat is anywhere from $300 to $400 a piece. Then I had Jamaicans stopping by. And they would say the same thing. And then I had the Hispanic population. So I'm sitting here listening to these people, and I'm like, forget the grazing part of it, because that takes a little time to set up the fence to restrict the goats from getting out of the yard. Right. So all I really have to do is breed them and sell them.
Wow.
And that's a market in itself. So that's the model.
And you know,
I love
curry goat. I do. Okay. I know some of you folks might be vegetarian, but I'm sorry. I love curry goat. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I have a lot of people asking for it, but there's no slaughtering on the property. So when they come to get the goat, they got to take the live goat out.
I know that's right.
Occasionally, I'll sell chickens, and people will come in and buy a chicken for $20, and they'll wrap it up by his feet and put it in the trunk of the car live.
Wow.
So I eliminate all of that production, the slaughtering piece of it. I don't want to get involved in that.
Right. I understand that. Let me see if anybody on the board has any questions for you, Officer Crenshaw. I see Officer Mason is still here, and also Officer Harper is here. Do you guys have a question for our guest regarding goats, chickens, and bees?
I just learned something about chickens that I think is my sister kind of raises a few, but I didn't know this, and that when the eggs are collected from egg laying, there's a difference between egg laying chickens and eating chickens, and that if you take the eggs, you can actually keep them longer than store bought eggs if you don't wash them. That's what I've heard. Is that true?
Yeah, that is correct. There's a bloom when the egg is laid. The chicken, there's a bloom that covers the egg. It's a protective cover. So if you don't wash it, the bloom will stay on there. And then you can store the eggs at room temperature. But if you wash the bloom off, then the egg is no longer protected and you have to refrigerate it.
Wow. That's new to me. I never heard it. So it's kind of like as you said, it's like a protective covering. As long as you don't disturb it, it'll last. Now, how long will it last?
Anywhere from two to 3 weeks, room temperature. Yep.
Okay. Now, they have expirations on egg cartons. They got expirations on everything. You know, it used to be where things said expires on such and such date, but now a lot of stuff just says best used by.
Yeah.
Now, that's a play on words in my opinion. It's going to taste better if you use it by this date, is what I'm thinking they're saying.
Right.
But it's still an expiration date. It's still bad, right, to eat it after that point or beyond that point.
I mean, I've used it a couple of days after, but so normally when I collect the eggs, my eggs they're probably only in my refrigerator for a day or two. I mean, I'm literally moving them that quick. But you know what I just thought about since you brought that up, and I may need to look into that, because I don't put an expiration date on there, but there's an expiration date that was on the carton before I received it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I never thought about that. I guess that's something to consider. I need to go
I'm
back
glad to
the
be of, I'm glad to be of some sort of assistance, my friend.
But I suspect that most of the people are eating them pretty quickly. So,
okay.
It is home-based business.
Now, back to the bees. I remember, and by the way, you guys, I used to live just a few blocks away from Mr. Morgan, and I remember when he first had, and I got to tell you, this is just so amazing to see. He's on Hurt Road. He had just a couple of hives there, and you have, 9 acres of land, right?
That's correct.
And 9 acres of land. He had just two hives there. I didn't know what they were at first, and then later on it dawned on me until one day, at one point I saw him out there with his, his coverings on. I said, oh, that's beehives. And now, or down the road, I saw all these hives all the way across the front of his yard, his house, his back, and everything. Last time we talked, I think you had 60 beehives. How many do
that's
you
correct.
Have now?
I still have about the same amount, but I'm looking to grow. I'm actually working with an 81-year-old beekeeper right now. I go to his house as an apprentice twice a week in Lula, Georgia. It's an hour and a half from my house going up 985. And this guy has a seventh grade education. He's been keeping bees since 1950. He's been commercial since 1970, and that he's been making a feeding his family from the bee business ever since. And I'm looking at him like, I need to get some of that money. So he's helping me. he's teaching me the tricks of the trade to go from 60 beehives. So he's told me by the end of the summer, I should be at 200 or 300.
How many does he have?
Wow.
He has thousands.
How many of you? Now, you also shared the last time you were on the show about how, these folks who have thousands of bees will take the bees to
farmers to pollinate their plants, right? So
that's correct. So if you go to
and they're making money off that, yeah, go ahead and explain how that whole thing works.
So okay, so if you the number one vegetable fruit and vegetable industry in the state of Georgia is blueberries. Those blueberries are not pollinated by the neighborhood bees. They have to be pollinated by truckloads of bees that are shipped in. So the beekeeper will ship in, let's say, a tractor trailer load of bees, and you can get 450 beehives on a tractor trailer. The farmer is going to pay that beekeeper $50,000 to drop those bees. They're going to stay there for about a month, month and a half, and then they're going to come back and collect the beehives. They're going to harvest the honey, and then they're going to take it to the watermelon farm, the whatever other farm that they got a contract with. They're going to go from farm mm-hmm. to farm because they have to be pollinated by a honeybee, right?
Mm.
So if you're in the bee industry, you can do pollination. You can just rent your bees out and make a living. That is an industry in Georgia. The model that I'm taking is I do the classes at my house, but this guy's he's telling me, and he doesn't even sell honey. He's like, that's a waste of time. The money is in the selling of the bees. So he's been showing me, I was talking to him the other day, he has an order for 100 beehives at $200 a piece. He's like, sometime during the summer, over the years, there's nothing for him to be walking around with $30,000 to $40,000 cash, a cash transaction, and he sold thousands of bees. And I'm looking at him like, I just need to get a cut of that.
Me too.
And so we joked about it one day, so I don't want to sound kind of crazy to the audience, but he was like, because he's 81. I just turned 57. Looking at him like, okay, this guy definitely has the knowledge, but, you know, he's on borrowed time. And I could die tomorrow, right? And so one day he's like, you need to come at least twice a week because I might not be here. And I said, well, I've thought about that, but you said it first. I didn't say anything. We laughed and joked about that. But here's the thing. This guy, I've been going to him for probably about 3 months. If he died tomorrow, I've gotten my money back because I had to pay him $500 because how it works.
Wow.
He's too old to physically do the work. So what he does is he takes students, they pay him $500, and he'll sit there and tell you what to do. But he's giving you the industry, and nobody else.
Mm-hmm.
I've been keeping bees for 4.5 years, and nobody has taught me as much as he has. And he's not a master beekeeper. But there are other people that are master beekeepers because they've taken the exam, they passed it. But he was like, his point to me was, well, how many of those master beekeepers that you know make a living at keeping bees? And I said, none of them. He said, they just took the exam and they put the certificate on the wall. I make a living every day by keeping bees. And I looked at him like, I never thought about it that way.
Right.
So I'm trying to get all the knowledge I can from him because one day I am going to be him.
Right.
I'm going to be
too
old, and I'll have people coming to me, and I'm like, this is how you go from 50 to 60 beehives to 300 or 1,000. He said within the next couple of years, you should be well over 1,000 to 2,000 beehives. So if I had 1,000.
And then when you get to his age, and you can't physically do it anymore, you can be like, well, you're going to pay me to get my knowledge that I got from someone else that
you're
got
gonna
from
pay
someone
me.
Else.
You're going to – exactly. That's the model. You're going to pay – if you want to know how the tricks in the trade,
mm-hmm.
you're going to pay me. It's not free.
Wow.
Because I didn't get it for free.
Exactly. Exactly. So you had about
right.
– you got about 10 students at $500 a WAP. Man.
Easy. And he said during the summer he might have 20 students easily. But keep in mind, that's nothing. He's selling thousands of beehives at a time. Queen bee is $35. He sells thousands of them. And he's showing me, like, I already know how to make one hive and make, I already know how to make four or five queens. He's one of the things.
Let me ask everybody on the panel here that's listening to this, though. I mean, I'm sure many of you are probably in awe and like, you know, like, what? You know, did any of you ever have any clue that this was such a big or such a profitable industry whatsoever? Anyone can answer. Did you have any clue or ever thought about it or ever heard of it?
Hey, Mike, if you would, really, because I'm just getting this education, I'm loving this. Could he go into a little bit of the I don't know, parasite or whatever that was killing bees? Have we recovered from that? Where are we at with that?
No, they haven't recovered from it. It's called the varroa mite. It's V-A-R-R-O-A, mite. It came into the United States about 30 years ago from China, and they're still dealing with it. But you have to – they haven't eradicated it. But what they've done is you have to vaporize the actual hives with a certain acid, and it doesn't affect the bees, but it affects the mites. It doesn't kill all of them, but it will reduce the number. They'll always have the parasite until they find out how to eradicate it. But as long as their numbers, the mite numbers, don't exceed the bee population, so at least 3 to 4 times a year you have to treat the beehive for parasites, because they do have parasites.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. Thank you, because I tell you, I love honey. And you know what? And I'm going to say it's good to hear a brother that's doing farming with chickens and eggs and bees. Man, because we get so sometimes urban that we don't know how to sustain on that survival aspect. So, man, I'm proud of you. Hopefully, Michael, hook me up with your number. I can call you, and I can get on that honey list.
No problem. But, you know, I'm glad you brought that topic up, because that's one of the things that Mike and I was talking about the other day. So when I was in college, when I was in high school, college, everybody was like, in the 80s, everybody was like, oh, you got to go work for corporate America. I've worked for corporate America for the last 30, 33 years. And I just quit my job about 3 months ago. And I decided to go full-time farmer. So I'm a full-time farmer. And I was a food service director at a retirement community, but the pandemic caused too many problems in the restaurant/food service business, because nobody wants to work. They're overworking employees, and they're not paying them, but everybody does not see the big picture. I was salaried, and I had already been hustling this business for the last 3 to 4 years, and I've been growing it and growing it and growing it. But One week, sometime in, I think, October, I worked 90 hours for a job that paid me salary, and they only paid me for 40. The second week, I worked 75. And I started doing the math, and I'm like, this is crazy. And I went to my boss, and I went to the administrator, and I'm like, listen, we have to fix this, because I'm working all these hours. You know what their response to me was?
Mm-hmm.
We appreciate all your hard work. There was no bonus. There was no extra money, no gift cards or any of that. And I went, and they kind of glossed over my concern. And I gave them two solutions. One, put a sign out front saying that we're hiring, which they didn't do. And then two, I said, why don't you hire a chef so the chef is cooking the food and I can manage like I'm supposed to do it. They didn't do it. I went home for the next couple of days, and I crunched some numbers on what I was doing, and I crunched some more numbers, and I was tossing and turning all night. And I crunched the numbers the next morning. I said, you know what? I'm done. I'm going to work for myself. I am not going to work. I'm not going to give you 50 hours of labor for free.
Mm-hmm.
And the only response is, we appreciate all your hard work. Now, here's the catch. A lot of people working in the restaurant industry don't do the math.
Mm.
I, in the restaurant industry, if you work, and most of the times they'll tell you you work 50 hours, but you never leave until the job is done. When it's all said and done, you might work 60, 70 hours. But when you divide that 60 or 70 hours by your weekly income, oh, your pay rate just went down. Right?
And let alone when they tax you, and then when the taxes take the other part of it, yeah, when you do the full breakdown, right?
Right.
Mm.
So,
hey, Albert, I can
make more money, but so that's why I'm doing bees, goats, chickens. I go to work when I want to go to work. I set my own prices. And one of the other things, because I have at least 9 streams of income from bees. It's not just selling honey. It's not just selling the bees. I have at least 9 streams of income coming from the bees. And I set the price. And I don't have to talk to anybody. I don't have to be inspected. My neighbors can't say anything. I work at my own pace. And I'm sitting here learning the game from this 81-year-old man. And I'm like, I'm going to get this knowledge because I already see the picture 10, 15 years down the road. This is clear as day.
Right. I think Janet had a question there. Go ahead, Janet.
I was just making a comment because I used to be salary, and I know what you're talking about because I was told why pay you when I got you for free because I was doing so many different things, you know, and people take advantage of that. And, you know, and when you crunch numbers, like you said, you realize it's time to leave, and I left.
And here's the thing. Some of us are so happy to have the job, and they look at you like, he ain't going nowhere. She ain't going nowhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Then you do the math, and you're like, you know what? I'm out of here. But there's so many people that don't do the math. They're just so happy to have the job. Everybody does not have that entrepreneurial spirit, so that's why they're stuck in that job. That's why they take the abuse at the job because they don't have anywhere else to go.
Wow.
And I was like, I'm going to do this, and that's exactly what I'm doing.
Awesome, brother. Seriously awesome. I mean,
and I'm not boasting. It's just that I saw the light. I was like, I can't do this anymore. I cannot work in this restaurant. So anytime, like, I'm going to give you a prime example. When you go in, I'm not even going to name the restaurant. When you go in some of these really busy restaurants, look at the manager and talk to him. I bet you he's been there 15 hours a day. Sometimes 6 days a week. He only getting paid for 40.
Right. He's on salary. He's salary. He don't punch clock.
And nobody's going to stop you from working them hours. Nobody.
Mm-hmm. Or better yet, what they'll do, they give you an ultimatum. Either you do it or you can kick rocks. They'll find somebody else that would do what they wanted you to do. Oh yeah, I know the game. I've seen it. You know, even where I work at, you know, folks were saying, Mike, you need to be the supervisor of this department. I said, you know, I don't know about that. I said, okay, I'll go ahead and do it. But they got somebody else to do it. But that somebody else comes to me and wants me to do their job. I'm like, no, I don't make what you make. when they pay me what you make, I'll be more than happy to help. But at this point in time, I'm quietly quitting. You've heard that term now, quietly quitting of doing. Because,
you know,
and that's interesting that you mentioned that because there's been some conversations on news medias and everything about where people used to want to do more for the companies. You know what I'm saying? Would go all out. But now they don't. Folks are like, that's interesting.
But the employee has to recognize that. If you're not smart enough to recognize that, you will never know. You will never know.
Yeah.
When it comes to
Go
ahead, Jamie. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, because when I crunched the numbers, I realized I was making more by staying home and just going out on pension and disability than to sit there and drive and do all the other things that I was doing. No more stress,
yep.
You know? And so, like
yep.
you said, kept crunching the numbers. I figured out I was going to not miss anything. I was going to profit.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to say that where, you know, that's another thing is that where the stress factor, you were working for a company. I'm pretty sure you dealt with some stressful issues. Share with us if you don't mind. We only have about maybe 10 minutes ago, 9 minutes ago. But how do you feel now that you know, you don't have someone looking over your shoulder, that no one is trying to push you to this and that, you can schedule yourself? You have
so
control.
It's funny you say that. I was telling my wife, and I've told a couple of friends. So in the restaurant business, you always have to have your phone on. So I was a general manager at a retirement community. So I was over the entire operation. But if the cook called out, I'm the cook that day. If one of the attendants called out and I didn't have enough staff, I'm the person. And they will call you at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, I'm not coming in today. Well, breakfast starts. They start cooking breakfast at 5 o'clock, and I'm an hour away. So I'm already going to be late. Like, right? I don't get those calls.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have an employee, because it's a one-man show. I don't have an employee with all their issues, the babysitting issues, their spouse issues, whatever issue they're dealing with, not wanting to work. I don't have to deal with any of that. So
wow.
I normally get up at 6. I might start working by 8, 9 o'clock, just depending on what I got going on. But I do work just about all day to about 6, 7 o'clock. But it's not – I'm not pressured, right? There's no pressure.
Right.
I don't have
wow.
anybody come out, hey, I need this by such a – I don't operate that way. Now we're operating on my time. Now, if somebody's paying me to do a certain thing, of course, I'm going to meet that deadline. But for the most part, the bees, the ghosts, the chickens are waiting on me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
right.
how I operate. I haven't been stressed in 3 months.
Well, now, Officer Mason, I believe, is still here. Officer Mason, you're here in the ATL, correct?
Yes, sir.
And
no,
let's
by
see,
the way,
Janet Davis. And Janet Davis is here in the ATL, right? So let's find a piece of land and we can get ourselves a few bees, hives, and maybe some goats and some chickens, and get Mr. Morgan to show us how to be entrepreneurs.
Wait a minute,
Janet has a good little piece of land that we can at least put some bees on. Maybe not goats and chickens, but we can put some bees on there. You know, she's got enough
yeah.
land back there to put some bees, Janet. So, you know, we might want to look into this.
Okay.
Here's the crazy thing. So I consider myself a fifth generation farmer. All of my ancestors, including my dad, we have family property in North Carolina. They all farm that land. I have bees in North Carolina right now. But I don't work the land. I just have livestock. I have bees. Bees are considered livestock if you didn't know that.
I didn't.
So there are many people that live in this that have land in Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Virginia, but they live somewhere, but they're not farming it. Only thing they're doing with that land is they're paying the taxes on it. And here's
taxes.
The crazy
thing. I was about to say that, just paying the taxes, right?
Nobody wants to do that hard work. Nobody wants to do that
mm-hmm.
anymore. And I took a step back and said, you know what? This is what I'm going to do. We don't respect the farmers like they used to. And I said, you know what?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going back to this, and this is the way I'm going to do it. And I'm not stressing. I'm making money.
Wow.
But there are people that have farmland right now. I know people that have 50-plus acres of farmland, and all it's doing is sitting there, and they pay the taxes every year. When they actually
draining
leasing
them
it out
of money,
somebody, it could be leasing it out, but they don't know how to do it.
Right.
Because
right.
when their parents were alive, they did. They wanted to go to the city. Everybody wants to live in the city.
Mm-hmm.
You look down on the poor people on the farm, but there's some farmers, big farmers. I can tell you this. Some of them people that have the big farms and the orchards and stuff, they're not poor. But that goes into slavery. That's a whole generational thing.
Mm-hmm.
You go to South Georgia, you see some of those pecan farms or some of those peach farms. They've had it in their family for generations, but it started off of our back. We don't even want to go down that road, do we?
I follow this one family, the Arms family. I follow them. And they raise cows. They raise pigs. They have goats, more so goats than anything else. Now, the cows that they raise for their own, you know what I mean? They raise the cows, and then they take them off to be slaughtered. And, you know, they got a freezer full of meats for, you know, months and months. And it's so crazy because they actually name the cows. Treat them like pets, you know, like one of them they called Big Mac. And then the next one that they got, they named him Whopper, you know. But after a certain amount of time, they take them to, I'm seriously. But
right.
they, I mean, they have a farm where they actually, you know, raise, you know, chickens and goats, as I said. Their main thing is goats. And they got where they live is beautiful. They got a lake and, you know, lakes and streams and everything. I mean, and they work the land. It's not like, you know, they just sit around. They do the work, like you said. They actually get
right.
up every morning, do what needs to be done. And then with their followers on social media, hell, they're selling T-shirts, caps, everything that. The wife
you
got her own little thing, you know, and now they're making money off of their social media connection. That's crazy.
Right. There's
you
money
know.
In it. The thing is, do you want to do the work to do it? Or you just want to keep
right.
going to corporate America and making your $15, $20, $25 an hour? Hey, it's up to you.
That's crazy. Mm-mm-mm. Well, look, you guys, we're down to 1 minute left on the show. Janet, before we get out of here, please share your final thoughts. As the lady
well,
of the show, what's your final thought?
Yes, I truly enjoyed the show. I enjoyed you, Mr. Morgan, and you will be seeing me soon. So you got my email address. Send me your information, or you said I could look you up online so I can figure out exactly where on Hurt Road you are.
Okay.
Because I'm going to come get some eggs and honey.
Michael, can I give out my website?
Sure. Yes, definitely. Please do.
So I do have a website, and you can order honey directly from me. It's www.beansbeesandhoney. That's B-E-A-N-S, bees, B-E-E-S, and honey.com.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So I got 44 seconds. Again, I want to thank Officer Mason, Officer Crenshaw, Officer Harper, Janet Davis, and everyone else, and, of course, our guest, Mr. Morgan, for joining in today. 32 seconds left. We're out of here. Have a blessed remainder of your weekend. Don't forget, tune in to Cotton Campbell tomorrow night on Let's Talk About It here on the TMGN, the Michael Gay Network. Good night, y'all. Peace.
Good night.
Good night.